And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Hear that music? That's workout music. And yes, it is time for Hands-On Apologetics. Welcome, everybody. It's great to be with you today. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, where we throw down air, I guess you could say, and also build up our critical thinking skills and just learn a lot about the church, about Jesus, and how to know and love him better. It's great to be with you today. We've got a great program, as always, and we're going to continue our series with Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley. He's coming into Dojo, and the topic is how to drive your friends sane. I love that. So what are we going to talk about? Well, if you've been following the series with Ken, we have been talking about how non-believers, how atheistic worldview just doesn't seem to cohere, doesn't make sense, doesn't connect well with our experience, with reality. And so he's been picking apart slowly, just looking at things from different perspectives. And today we're going to look at the issue of human rights. And what's the connection between human rights and God? Is there a connection? And is it possible for a non-believer to anchor human rights in something other than God? Well, Ken Hensley's going to come out, and we're going to explore that issue. Can't wait. It's always fun to have Ken in the dojo and work through these issues. Like I said, it's always, always fun. And also, since we are here to sharpen our skills as apologists, we have our Finding the Fallacy segment, which today's fallacy is the appeal to pity, and also the Meet the Early Church Fathers. And today's Early Church Father is Victor Avita. Not exactly a household name, but nevertheless, a very interesting father and a really cool quote, by the way, that I'm going to share with you from him. And as always, you are part of the program. So if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, especially when Ken comes on the show, at 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. It's always great to hear from the audience. And as always, you can email us. Now, I know a lot of people, calling a live show can be intimidating, but nevertheless, there are important issues, questions, maybe objections that people have thrown at you that you're not really sure how to answer. Well, let us be your lifeline. Send us an email here at Hands On Apologetics at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's questions@handsonapologetics.com, all one word. And I'll read it, and I'll do my best to answer you, or at least send you to some good resources where you can find answers. And I answer everything, but not everyone makes it on the radio. So sometimes soon we really need to have a broadcast where we go into the dojo mailbox, because the mailbox is beginning to overflow with emails, if that's possible in the virtual world. But you get the point. So anyway, it's also time for our shout-outs. I want to welcome those watching live stream on social media, such as Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see familiar names there in the chat room over at YouTube. Thank you very much. All right, and thank you, listening on radio. We welcome you, and also, by the way, you can access our programs not only through radio, not only through live stream on social media, but you can also get it via podcast, either through the Virgin Most Powerful phone app or the master website for Virgin Most Powerful, which is Virgin Most Powerful Radio, all one word, folks, .com. Check it out. All the programs are there, not only for Hands-On Apologetics, but also all the other awesome programs that Virgin Most Powerful produces. Good stuff all around. And so without further ado, why don't we jump into our Finding the Fallacy segment? And today's fallacy is the appeal to pity. The appeal to pity. What is the appeal to pity? Well, it's an appeal to pity is a fallacy in which someone tries to win support for an argument or an idea by exploiting his or her opponent's feelings of pity or guilt. Okay, so it's a kind of an appeal to emotion. So I'm not sure I'd word it quite that way, because it can also be trying to exploit not only pity or guilt of your opponent, but especially the audience. Okay, so it's a type of emotion manipulation where, you know, we appeal to things for the children, let's say, you know. That's an appeal to pity, because it's not a question of whether something is right or wrong or good or better or best. It's not a matter of arguments or evidence. It's this heart tug, you know, do it for the children. Or, you know, do it because you should feel guilty about something. You know, you can pick out millions of different examples of where either it's you're trying to win somebody's sympathy, or you're trying to make somebody feel guilty in order to manipulate them. And by the way, for those parents who are listening, you know, the Finding the Fallacy segment is very helpful, because you'll find out your kids almost intuitively know which fallacies to appeal to. And this is a great way you could train them in critical thinking. You point out, no, you're appealing to pity. Now give me some explanations why you should be doing this. Oh, by the way, you know, as always with Finding the Fallacies, or fallacies, I should say, there's usually a number of different names given. Another alternate name to the appeal to pity is the Galileo argument. So it's an appeal to the scientist's suffering as a result of his house arrest by the Inquisition. So that's the alternate title for this. And we really should do a show on Galileo. We haven't really talked about him, but it's kind of funny. Yes, Galileo suffered so much while on house arrest in his chalet overlooking the Tuscanese, being served by his servants and entertaining house guests. Yes, the Inquisition was quite fierce. Without further ado, while we jump to meet the early church fathers, Victor Avita is our early church father. And I love this segment, folks, because I've been working with the early church fathers ever since I got interested in apologetics, you know, years ago. And I'm still learning new things. And so it's kind of cool to go through all these early church fathers, because there are some that, quite frankly, I never heard of. And but it's good to know. And Victor Avita, I think, falls in that category. Very, you know, as usual, you know, the ones that we really don't hear of are the ones that we don't have a lot of information on. We know very little about Victor, other than he was the Bishop of Vita, which is in the African province of Bicinia. He's the author of The History of the African, the Persecutions of the African Province, which recounts the terrible sufferings of Catholics in Africa at the time of the Vandal King Gaislerdus and Hunderic. I think I got their names. Gaislerdus is from 428 to 477 AD, and Hunderic from 477 to 484 AD. Now, this persecution is as bloody as any that occurred under the imperial Rome, pagan Rome. But this was not a general persecution of Christianity as such, but specifically Catholics being persecuted as distinct from Arians. The Vandals, by the way, the barbarian horde that like invaded into Italy and elsewhere, they were nominally Christian, but like all barbarian Christians, with the exception of the Franks, Christianity came to them in Arian form. Now, Arians were the ones who denied that Jesus is eternal, co-eternal with the Father, and that in a sense he's kind of a lesser God than the Father. This is probably right around the end of the great Arian heresy, where orthodoxy was just starting to ascend. But nevertheless, it's through these barbarians that a lot of bloodletting in North Africa. So Victor, in his History of the Persecution in the Province of Africa, was written about 488, 489. He wrote about the persecution until Hunneric, who died in December of 484. Now, I want to do this quote for you. This is a really cool quote from that work. And he says this, quote, "Because we could profess that there are two natures in the Son, that is, true God and true man, having body and soul, whatever the Scriptures ascribe to him that is of sublimely excellent power, we know we must attribute it to his wonderful divinity. and whatever is told more humbly of him, and which is below the dignity of the heavenly power, we refer not to the word of God, but to the manhood which he assumed. This then, as we remarked earlier, is said in regard to his divinity. The Father and I are one, and whoever sent me has, or whoever seen me has seen the Father. But there are other sayings which refer to him according to his humanity, namely, the Father is greater than I. What a great quote. And it's great. I think one of those things that every Catholic apologist should keep in their back pocket, especially if you're talking to somebody like the Jehovah's Witnesses who deny that Christ is true God. And what they'll do, folks, is they'll appeal to all those passages in Scripture where it speaks of Christ in terms of his humanity. You know, they'll talk about Jesus, getting tired, getting thirsty, you know, things that are proper to human nature. And what they'll exclude or they'll reinterpret is all those passages that refer to his divinity. Like when he says, the Father and I are one, they'll say, well, see, he's just one will in one accord with them, but not of his nature one. So what Victor Avita says is what we should do whenever we're going through scriptures is whenever we see something that ascribes to Christ sublime, excellent power, we attribute it to his divinity. Whatever is to human things, we subscribe to his humanity. Great advice from Victor Avita, our early church father for today. Coming up on the other side of the break, Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley. Talking about human rights.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. And yeah, I should thank Elizabeth and Beth. Thank you so much for the emoji explosion. Very colorful. Forgot to give you my shout-out there. Yeah, let's talk about theistic apologetics, shall we? And to help us work through... dealing with non-believers, trying to show them that God is indeed necessary. We are going to welcome Master Apologist Ken Hensley into the dojo. Kenneth Hensley is a nationally known Catholic teacher and author who, since converting to the Catholic Church in 1997, has worked extensively in the field of apologetics. He's been interviewed by numerous sources, Catholic radio, television, and he's a frequent speaker. And also, you can check out all his great stuff at his website, which is www.kennethhensley.com. And Ken, welcome to Hands On Apologetics. Site, which is
Hey, Gary, it's good to see you for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the first time.
On the show.
Oh, yeah, that we actually can converse and look at each other. So it's great for me. I don't know if it's good for you, though.
No, it's good. It's good. I like it better. It makes for a better conversation when, you know, as you said, when I'm not just sort of like walking in circles around my office with a phone against my ear.
Exactly. For some reason, I can think a lot better with a headset than holding something up to my face. It's just, it's so unnatural. But
anyway. Yeah. Also, I can see the look on your face now if you're becoming desperate to cut in on me.
Yes, folks, that's the beautiful thing about live stream. You can see when I give the cutoff sign. Well, hey, Ken, this has been a fantastic series where you've just been dismantling piece by piece how incoherent the atheistic worldview is with just experience and common sense reality. If you could, for those who may be just tuning in or just jumping mm-hmm. into this series, what is your major premise?
Well, if I could, I want to begin by reading again a short quotation from atheist philosopher of mind, John Searle. Okay. He writes, I quote, "There is exactly one overriding question in contemporary philosophy. How do we fit in? How can we square this self-conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational, etc., agents? How can we square this with a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles?" The reason I read that is that this is a good way of, I guess, summarizing the approach that I take. Here's a modern atheist philosopher of mind, and he's stating that the primary question in contemporary philosophy, I mean, the question above all other questions, in his mind at least, is how do we fit in? That is, how do we square the fact that on the one hand, we atheists, he's saying, believe in a universe comprised of nothing but brute physical particles interacting with one another according to laws of chemistry and physics. How do we square that with the conception that we have of ourselves as meaningful, I mean, meaning-creating, rational, free, moral beings? And the fact that he says that this is the number one issue in contemporary philosophy, he says to me that, you know, he doesn't quite know how to square them. And my point in apologetics, or the approach that I take in evangelism with those who doubt or deny the existence of God, is precisely to put my finger on this question in a sense and kindly, gently, lovingly not let up, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason I do that is that in the contemporary situation, you know, where scientism has sort of, conquered, and the idea is that science is the only path to true knowledge, and the scientist is way up here and everybody else is way down there. There's this feeling that comes from modern atheists that they can sort of lean back against the wall and twiddle their thumbs, you know, self-satisfied, that they have nothing to demonstrate. It's just up to us, Gary. They can throw the ball into our court and say, "Hey, you say there's a God, prove it." You know, make an argument. "Nah, not good enough. Give me another argument." "Nah, I don't like that one either. Give me a better argument." Aquinas' arguments. "Come on, Richard Dawkins answered them in two paragraphs. Bring me something else." And my point is that is not entirely accurate. It's true that we are presenting a worldview when we say that God exists, but they are also presenting a worldview when they say that nothing exists but material substances, and that everything that we see around us, everything we experience, everything that we are, can be explained in terms of physical particles. They're presenting a worldview as well. And so my approach is to say to them, okay, if this is your worldview, then I want you to at least feel the tension, because I claim that you cannot even explain the most basic and fundamental aspects of our experience as a human beings in terms of your materialist worldview. And then I proceed to go one element after another to try to show them that they can't square us. They cannot square us. In order to square us with their atheist worldview, they have to reduce us down to nothing. Anyway.
Yeah, so it's completely, when you get down to it, they have a point of view that doesn't really cohere with, you know, how things truly are. In other words, it's almost like a kind of insanity.
Yes, I would say so, yes.
Yeah, so we've been working through, you know, like moral. Last program we talked about morals, where, you know, where can an atheist or non-believer anchor a moral system other than God? And you did a great job showing how all the different avenues just simply don't work.
Or at least all the different avenues turn out to be arbitrary.
Yeah.
And they turn out to be inconsistent. They're arbitrary because, let me back up one step. Okay. If it is true that nothing exists in this universe but particles, and everything that all the complexity we see is just the evolution of particles by random mutation and natural selection, no God, no human soul, no human spirit, nothing but particles, nothing but physics in a sense, nothing but chemistry, then there is no objective foundation for moral law in that world. You know, most atheists would admit that. Yeah, they would say, objectively speaking, yeah, I don't believe that there's some moral law just floating around out there, you know, that came from nowhere. So yeah, objectively speaking, there is no basis for believing in moral law, and therefore you just have to create your own basis. And some people will say, well, you know, I think that you know, whatever the majority says at any given time is probably the best basis we can have for determining right and wrong. And that turns out to be arbitrary, because the Marquis de Sade can say to that person, he can say, hey, look, you know, I have evolved up out of the mire. I've come from nowhere in this accidental universe, and I've only got 60 or 70 years before I return to nowhere for all eternity. So don't tell me that I have to abide by whatever the majority says. I'll do whatever I want in these 60, 70 years I have. You know, so everything you set forward, whether it's whatever the majority says or whatever I say is right and wrong, or, oh no, we'll gather these scientists together and we'll let them decide what's right and wrong. Any standard you create is just that. It's a created standard. It's arbitrary, meaning that I don't have to follow it. Why should I follow it? And it's inconsistent, because if atheism is true, then the law of this world is the law of the fittest. It's the survival of the fittest. Nature is red in tooth and claw. So don't tell me that I shouldn't kill Gary Machuda if I want to get at that fine set of books that I see behind him on Skype right now.
Uh-oh.
I mean, after all, Gary Machuda is nothing but a bundle of protoplasm anyway.
Yeah.
So why can't I get rid of him if I want the books?
Yeah. So in a sense, it's impossible to have a moral imperative that is incumbent upon everybody. And the best you could do is to look at the laws of nature, not natural law, but, you know, like you said, the survival of the fittest. But the problem with that is nature is completely immoral, or amoral, I should say.
Right.
You know, tigers don't have guilt complexes because they killed a little lamb for dinner.
No. No, not at all. And, yeah.
No, so that whole thing kind of spiders throughout, you know, the whole moral universe. And I know today, and what I love about this series, folks, is that what Ken's doing is he's just chipping away, you know, piece by piece, showing how incoherent some of these things are. And so that also impinges upon human dignity, human rights, lots of things that we take for granted and non-believers appeal to, right?
Yeah. I can't remember exactly what we've gone through so far, Francis Schaeffer was a pretty famous evangelical apologist, and he used to speak of the mannishness of man. That is what makes human beings really human. And what I'm saying is that you can go aspect by aspect of what makes us human and just chip them away and realize that they don't have any foundation in an atheist worldview. I think we began with human dignity or human value. And I simply made the point that most of us seem to know intuitively that human beings possess a special value, and yet there's no grounds for that in an atheist worldview. If you really are a consistent atheist, then you have to say Ms. Newkirk said, who was the president of PETA, I think she still is, when she said, you know, something like a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. They're all mammals. What's the difference? You know, we don't make any moral distinction between them. And so you cannot really ground in pure atheism. You can't ground the idea of assigning to human beings any special dignity or value. And yet as human beings, we do that. And, you know, if you were to talk to an atheist and say, well, I did once, I asked an atheist online one time, so are you saying that you truly look at your son, your daughter, I think he had several children, and you're okay with saying to yourself that they have no more value objectively than the cockroach walking around in your basement, you know, that you assign value to them because they're yours and you know them and all that, but they don't really have any more value. And actually, he said, "Yeah, that's the truth." You know,
Wow.
Human value can't be grounded in atheism, and then objective rights and duties, you know, can't be grounded in atheism. And I think we're going to talk about rights today, human rights.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about Jennifer Fulweiler, who grew up an atheist. And one of those cracks that kind of led to an investigation and ultimately led her into the church was she was holding her newborn baby. And she was trying to think, you know, what is this baby I'm holding? Is it just a collection of molecules, you know, the product of, you know, millennia of evolution and really has no intrinsic value? And that she just realized she couldn't come to say that, you know, confronted with her own child. I hear the music coming up. Yeah, on the other side of the break, Ken, let's talk about could atheists say that we're endowed by not by a creator, but something else with inalienable rights? So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Kenneth Hensley about basically, is atheism coherent, especially when it comes to morals? And we're going to be talking about human rights. And Ken, I tried to do the tease before the break, but I kind of fumbled that one. But I guess I could set it up like this. The Declaration of Independence says that we're endowed by a creator with certain unalienable rights, namely life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Couldn't a person say, well, we don't have to say that that's necessarily endowed by a creator. Those things we can establish just as a non-believer.
Well, what I would say is that people can say anything. But they can't ground that rationally. If there is no creator to endow us with inalienable rights or unalienable rights, and think for a moment about what unalienable means. When I say that Gary Machuda possesses unalienable rights, what I'm saying is that you have rights that are inherent to you by creation that belong to you and cannot be alienated from you. You know, in other words, I'm saying that no one on earth has the authority to remove these rights from you. No one. That's what unalienable means. And if there is no creator, well, let's turn it around the other way first. If there is a creator, then the idea of us possessing unalienable rights just makes sense. It just flows naturally because God can give us these rights. We can be endowed by our creator with them. But if I say, on the other hand, that no, there is no God that created Gary Machuda. Instead, Gary's just an accident of nature, just a product of the swamp, you know, as it were. Or as one of my teachers used to say, an ape with a suitcase.
Well, for people who know me, that's actually a very feasible theory.
Well, actually, the funniest one that I heard. That one of my teachers used to say too is he used to refer to human beings as the forward edge of the sludge of evolution. Okay. Well, if that's true of you, I mean, if that's really the objective truth, that you are the forward edge of the sludge of evolution, then speaking of unalienable rights is just nonsense. You may have rights, but the only rights you could possibly have would be rights that are granted to you by someone else. Yeah. By everyone, you know, everyone agrees to give Gary these rights, or the dictator gives you the rights, or some small group, you know, decides on these rights. And of course, the problem with that is any right that's given to you by another entity could be taken away by another entity. And so the thing I find, you know, I mean, there's some humor in this. The thing I find humorous about this is that because every one of us is created in the image and likeness of God, we all know in our heart of hearts that people possess rights. Yeah. We all know that. And the atheist knows that. And so you'll find often that atheists are not the forward edge of the sludge of evolution, but are on the forward edge of the fight for human rights. You know, and often, yeah. you know, atheists will see these injustices in the world and care about them because they're made in the image of God, and they know that people have value. They know that people have rights, and they will lead the fight, against injustice and for human rights. And yet, lo and behold, they cannot account for this on the basis of their worldview. Their worldview as atheists doesn't provide any foundation for it.
Yeah, yeah. So, just the fact that it's unalienable. Like you said, if it comes from another person, then you could change it. So at one time, people had the quote-unquote, I don't know if they would say right, but the right to slavery. right?
Yeah.
We also have the corresponding right not to be a slave. So one government could take that away or give it or switch back and forth. You know, the age we live in, it just seems like it's just a never-ending, you know, enrollment of different kinds of rights.
Yeah, and there have been societies in the world, and they still exist, absolute dictatorships where, you know, I mean, North Korea is kind of like that, but there have been others in the past. You know, I think I gave in the article I wrote on this once the illustration of one of the Chinese emperors at the time when they were building the Great Wall of China, where, you know, in order to, you know, further the work and, you know, please the gods or whatever, he would regularly have people buried alive in the wall. And I guess he had, like a sorcerer came to him one time and said, you know, that he'd had a dream and that the work on the wall wasn't going well. And his dream was that you need to bury alive 10,000 people in the ramparts of the wall, and then things will go well. And so the emperor, you know, found some guy whose name in Chinese means 10,000 and buried him alive. Now, we hear things like that and we are just absolutely appalled. I mean, to our bones, you know, we're just appalled at the idea that one person could exercise that kind of power over others. And yet it's been done, you know, throughout history. It's done all the time. It was done by Mao Zedong, you know, after the Chinese Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, Cultural Revolution. It was done in Stalinist Russia. It's done in places all over the world where someone has absolute power over another person. And yet the atheist really can't complain about it. I mean, can't rationally complain about it. The atheist can complain, and the atheist will complain, because, again, the atheist is not what the atheist believes himself to be. The atheist is the image and likeness of God. The atheist has God's law written on his soul, you know, etched into his soul. And so he knows, and so it strikes him as absurd and horrible. And yet, strictly speaking, on an atheist foundation, you don't have a leg to stand on.
Yeah. So can the other thing that perplexes me is, how would you determine, like, what is a right? If God doesn't exist, and all that exists is just nature, material world, you know, a right is that's not a material thing, like justice or goodness. What would be a right? I mean, why even have that concept?
Well, when you say that a right is not a material thing, I think you're bringing up a really important point, because when you think about it, all the things we're talking about, human dignity and value are not material things.
Yeah.
Then we talk about morality, right and wrong. They're not material things. You know, you can't go to your sock drawer and open it up and find right in your drawer. Or you can't take wrong and go and hide it behind the garage, you know, in the weeds or something. They're not material things. And a right is not a material thing either. And so these are all abstract concepts that either have some grounding in the nature of the universe, yeah, and in a theistic universe, in a universe in which God exists, they all ground quite naturally, or they don't have any grounding. And then the answer to your question is, you're just making it up as you go along. You know, like the same with right and wrong. You know, in an atheist universe, right and wrong wind up being whatever we decide we like or dislike, and rights would be the same thing. Rights in an atheist universe are whatever we kind of decide that we want to give people, you know. And that's why you could say, well, they have the right to life. Do they have the right to liberty? And do they have the right to the pursuit of happiness? How about a house? Do they have a right to a house? Do they have a right to medical care? Do they have a right to food? Do they have a right to a bicycle? Do they have, you know, where you draw the line ends up just being your own thoughts as you think it through, you know, whatever you think makes sense.
Yeah. And ultimately, like you pointed out, that it ultimately comes down to might makes right in a sense, because the stronger person can bestow people, you know, rights on those who are weaker than them, or you could have a collective that allows, you know, the people under them to have certain rights, or you could have the state or totalistic state determine what is right, you know, people's rights and which ones they don't possess. It ultimately comes down to whoever's the strongest ultimately determines what is right, you know, who has rights.
I think of abortion as being a prime example of exactly what you're saying. Unborn children used to have rights in America.
Yeah.
And then, the tide swung another direction, and nine lawyers wearing black robes decided that they don't have rights. And now we live in a world where you said the stronger can exercise over the weaker. That's the ultimate classic example, that the mother, who is alive and who is large and has power, can exercise total rights over the unborn child. And yet, if the tide were to swing the other direction, and the laws were to be changed, then suddenly unborn children would have rights again. So they didn't have rights. I mean, they did have rights. Now they don't have rights. And then they could have rights.
Right.
Or maybe not. Or maybe they'll have rights in one country and not have rights in another country.
Yeah, exactly. Or here's another one, is that now the woman has the right to abort her child, but the father has no rights or no input on that question. Where in ancient Rome, it was the opposite, where the father determines whether the child's going to live or not, where the woman had no say in the thing. So it's like whoever has the say, which is totally arbitrary.
It's totally arbitrary. I was thinking back on our discussion last month about morality again. Mm-hmm. And, we were talking about the foundations of morality. And when I think about it, actually, the two most popular opinions these days, first of all, the opinion of Peter Singer, who was the bioethics professor at Princeton. I mean, he held the chair of bioethics at Princeton University. I'm not sure if he still does. I haven't checked recently. But he's an atheist. And he grounds morality in the idea of happiness. That is, whatever brings the greatest total amount of happiness in a situation is what is right. So that's what he's come to. Totally arbitrary. And also, when you begin to probe it, it becomes like your little probing of the abortion thing. It just starts to become unglued. Because the example he gives is that if a family was a happy family and then a child was born into the family that had really severe medical needs, and if the total amount of happiness was greater for the family with the child gone, then you could justify infanticide.
Yeah, very good.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
To the break, you were talking about how Princeton professor can propose that happiness is ultimately what's good and what's wrong, and if a unwanted child comes into a home and they'll make the family unhappy, then that would be bad.
Yeah, this is Peter Singer. He basically talked about the total amount of happiness.
Okay.
You know, so if the total amount of happiness in the family would be enhanced by the child not existing, then you could justify infanticide. Now, I don't know how far he went with that, you know, up to a month old, up to 6 month old, up to the fifth birthday. I don't really, you know, I know he didn't push it that far, but you can see again that it's completely arbitrary. And what could you not justify on the basis of happiness? I mean, what if Hitler could argue that the happiness of the German people is enhanced by, you know, getting rid of all the Jews or whatever, you know?
Yeah,
what could you not justify if what you're looking at is something as subjective as, you know, hey, family, what do you think will bring the total amount of happiness to the highest level? And the other person, the other philosopher now, an atheist philosopher named Sam Harris, who's probably the most popular atheist philosopher speaking and writing today, he takes as his standard for right and wrong, whatever increases human welfare and flourishing, that is the flourishing of rational creatures, whatever enhances their lives and their development and flourishing is what is right and wrong. And what he says is that although we may not know the answer to these questions, this question does have an answer, and scientists over time could find out what it is. That is, does it enhance the flourishing of human creatures to allow abortion to be legal, to have abortion be legal? If we do enough sociological studies and psychological studies, then we can find out scientifically whether this is something that enhances, and we can take our stand on it. So he takes this kind of scientific approach to deciding right and wrong, and winds up going down such interesting paths. Like, for instance, he says that Ted Bundy killed all those young women. When he did that, he was only doing what he had to do given his nature, and therefore, what he did, rather than saying what he did was immoral, or rather than saying what he did was evil, because now we're bringing in these moral words that don't really have any grounding in an atheist universe. He says, what we ought to say is that Ted Bundy was lousy at enhancing human flourishing and well-being. He was lousy at it. And since he was lousy at it, we should take him and put him in a cage. We should put him in prison, but we should think about what we're doing in the same way that we would think about taking a rattlesnake that maybe was like, you know, slithering around a neighborhood biting children and putting it in a cage. You know, you get rid of it, you put it in a cage simply because the snake is lousy at enhancing human flourishing and happiness. But we carefully avoid all moral language because morality doesn't really have any grounding. And so these are the most popular positions out there floating around.
Yeah. Yeah, what strikes me with both positions is that they speak of happiness or flourishing as if it's quantifiable. Like you can go down to the grocery store and pick up 5-pound bag of happiness, you know, or that a family would sit around and say, well, you know, we can get 13 pounds and 3 ounces more happiness if we let your baby sister live than if not. You know, how in the world could you quantify something like that?
That's why I say that what could you not justify in the end?
Yeah.
Because you're right. I mean, you're treating it like it's a commodity. Now, I guess Sam Harris would say, well, I've gone a step further, though, because rather than just sitting there and debating about what brings the greatest amount of happiness, I'm saying that there's an actual objective answer to the question of what increases human flourishing and well-being. And given enough time, we could figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. Sociological studies, psychological studies, scientific studies, we could figure out, you know, objectively whether whether this is right or that's wrong. But we won't call it a moral law because morality doesn't exist. We'll just call it, I mean, it'll be a practical law. It would be like, hey, we have found out that drinking arsenic doesn't enhance human flourishing and happiness. And so so now we're able to come out publicly and say, drinking arsenic is bad. And now we've got a moral law. Don't drink arsenic. But it's not a moral law. It's practical. Sam Harris effectively reduces moral laws to the level of traffic laws. It's like saying, you know, don't just go 80 miles an hour and turn, you know, and make a hard right turn at 80 miles an hour because it won't enhance human flourishing. You know, it's not because, I mean, no one would ever say you must drive on the right side of the road because it's immoral to drive on the left side.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could be either way. We could do like they do in England. We could drive on the left side of the road. But, you know, we set up these laws because they're practical and they enhance human flourishing. Sam Harris reduces morality to that.
Yeah.
And yet his position is the most popular one out there floating around among atheists now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because there's kind of an incoherence even amongst them, because if you take – let's take that example of the rattlesnake in the neighborhood that that needs to be killed because it doesn't enhance human flourishing. Well, the non-believers at PETA would say that by doing that, you are impeding upon their inalienable right to life of the rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. And after all, if a boy is the same as a rattlesnake, then, you know, who are you to say one species has a right and the other one doesn't?
That's right. That's the inconsistency part. You know, as I said, each one of these standards you come up with ends up being arbitrary. That is, you've just generated it out of nothing. And it ends up being inconsistent, you know, and anybody can come back like you just did. Any atheist can come back and say, hold on. You know, the snake was here first or whatever, you know. Yeah. And we should move the neighborhood, you know. It's speciesism to elevate the human above the snake and say the snake should be killed. Maybe the children should be killed.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's incoherent. You know what? Back briefly before we end up running out of time to the issue of rights.
Yeah.
I have this quotation here that I looked at from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I just want you to notice the language of it, how rationally what the Catholic Catechism teaches is grounded in our view of the universe. This is what it says. The unalienable rights of the person must be recognized and respected by civil society and the political authority. These human rights depend neither on single individuals nor on parents. There's a reference to the mother, the father, abortion. Nor do they represent a concession made by society, like, okay, we'll give in and we'll let Gary, you know, have the right to life and happiness. Nor do they represent a concession made by society and the state. They belong to human nature and are inherent in the person by virtue of the creative act from which the person took his origin. See, there's a perfectly clear and rational statement that someone who believes in God can make, that we who believe in God can make. Let me throw in one more point too, as we're winding down, something I brought up a couple of times, but atheists listening may have on their mind. I'm not presenting these arguments that we've been talking about so far as proofs of the existence of God. I believe there are very good proofs for the existence of God. But I'm not presenting these so far as proofs for the existence of God. I'm presenting them as arguments, though, for the existence of God. That is, they are arguments for God's existence by the absurdity of the contrary. That is, that if you try to assume that God doesn't exist, then you wind up tangled up in this mess of, although I believe that my children and grandchildren have special unique value because of my worldview, I have to admit they don't. And even though I believe in my heart of hearts that right and wrong are real, and that it's wrong to just, you know, for instance, take a child and just kill them for fun, my worldview forces me to say, well, it's not wrong, actually. Objectively speaking, I don't have any grounds for that. And even though I believe in my heart of hearts that people have rights and I'm willing to fight for the rights of human beings, I don't have any grounding for it. So these are arguments that the atheistic worldview, well, it cannot account for our experience as human beings, and not just our experience, but the most basic things that we believe as human beings and that we live by and that we have to live by. Because if you take these and discard them, if you just say to yourself, okay, I'm going to be rational, I'm going to be consistent, I no longer believe in the special value of humans, I no longer believe in right and wrong, I no longer believe in the rights of human beings. And if someone begins to live consistently in accordance with that, well, then we call them Hitler, Pol Pot, you know, Mao Zedong, you know, Ted Bundy.
Right. Yeah, well said. Well said. Wow. I tell everybody, this is the fastest hour on Catholic radio. I cannot believe that we just went through the entire program. Time flies when you're having fun. So, Ken, where can people get a hold of your material?
Well, if they want to purchase recorded talks that I've given on a bunch of subjects related to this and the Reformation and whatnot, it would be kennethhensley.com. There's a store page there for MP3 downloads, kennethhensley.com. But I work full-time for the Coming Home Network, and so I do most of my work day in and day out and blog there and also from the Coming Home Network, which is chnetwork.org would be the website. And just throw in a pitch then, when we get together next month, we're going to talk about the issue of meaning. Does human life, does human history have any meaning in an atheist universe?
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Well, you know, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Gary. It's always fun.
All right. Kenneth Hensley, everybody. Great stuff. Again, go to his website, kennethhensley.com. Lots of great stuff. And also Coming Home Network, chnetwork.org. Great information. Huge resource. In fact, I recommended it in my top 10 Catholic resources on the web. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to have the guy who started the modern Catholic apologetic movement, Carl Keating, master apologist, is going to come in. We're going through a series of books that every Catholic apologist ought to own. We're going to go into John Henry Newman's Essay on the Development of Doctrine. Awesome book. And coming up next, the Terry and Jesse Show, the dynamic duo of Catholic talk. Thank you so much for listening to this program. We appreciate it. And, man, it's already time to shut down the Midwest Command Center, turn off the dojo lights. All right. So, God willing, we will see each other tomorrow. And everybody, have a blessed day. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.